Hello and welcome to The Priest and the Prof. I am your host, the Reverend Deborah Duguid-May.
And I'm Dr. M. Elizabeth Thorpe.
This podcast is a product of Trinity Episcopal Church in Greece, New York. I'm an Episcopal priest of 26 years, and Elizabeth has been a rhetoric professor since 2010. And so join us as we explore the intersections of faith, community, politics, philosophy, and action. Welcome. In this episode, we are looking at how the Gospel of Mark and John present the identity of Jesus in relationship to empire, and specifically in their case, the Roman Empire under whose occupation they are. And I'm super glad today because Elizabeth is back with me. And
it's a big episode for me, people. I'm just all over this one.
So I'm glad it's not going to be a monologue. So it's interesting because Mark begins in his very first verse with this very direct political statement, the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now, many of us, when we're reading our own scriptures, may miss all of this, but good news, or in Greek, evangelion, was really a term used in the Roman Empire to announce the birth or a victory of an emperor. So a decree would go out into the world of the Roman Empire announcing the good news of Caesar Augustus, announcing a new emperor or some victory that had just taken place. So for Mark to use this term in the opening lines of his gospel is a way of saying a new emperor has arrived. It's saying that there is a new emperor and a new reign that is replacing the current regime. And in case anybody may have missed this, Mark, in the same opening sentence, follows up then with the Son of God. Now, Son of God was not a religious title per se in those days, but a political one during the Roman Empire, as emperors were called Son of the Divine One. And so by using this title, Mark is saying Jesus is the true Son of the Divine One, the Son of God, not Caesar Augustus. And so therefore, by implication, Jesus is the one with divine authority, not Caesar. So what we as readers now see when we read the opening lines of Mark is a religious proclamation. But at the time of Mark, this was primarily a direct political statement of who Jesus is, placing him in direct opposition to the Caesar of Rome and claiming him to be the new locus of divine authority and therefore political power. The very next verse of Mark tells us that of John the Baptist preparing the way for the Lord in the wilderness. Now, if we remember from the last two previous episodes, Mark is speaking to both Jews and Gentiles. And so now Mark is reminding the Jewish community of the symbolic power for them of the wilderness. For the Jewish community, the wilderness was the time immediately following their liberation from slavery in Egypt. It was the earliest days of liberation outside of Egyptian imperial control, when as a newly freed community, they were learning what it would mean to be a freed people that belonged to God. And so for the Jewish community, the wilderness was the time when God's kingdom began to take shape outside of the Egyptian kingdom. By stating that John the Baptist was preparing the way for Jesus in the wilderness was a way of saying God is about to call you out of oppression and slavery to Rome into freedom once again. Your liberation is just around the corner and the kingdom of God is about to begin again. And so these statements of Mark are deeply political because it's about a God who is always working to lead us out of oppression and slavery into freedom, not just religious freedom, but political freedom from occupying states and empires. So Jesus, as the new divine authority, is not one who will go out in conquest like Rome does, but instead will go out to release people from oppression and lead them into freedom. And then again, when Jesus is baptized, Mark has God self speaking from the heavens saying, "You are my beloved son." This is not just us as humans naming someone as the Son of the Divine One, but literally God speaking and naming Jesus as the divinely appointed one. And then still in the first chapter of Mark, we have Jesus himself going before all of us into the wilderness, that deeply symbolic place of new freedom. And it's in the wilderness that we see Jesus in Mark's gospel confronting every power that will lead to oppression. Our need for human power over others, our need and ego to prove ourselves, our desire for wealth. Jesus will confront, we see in Mark's gospel, not just the external oppressive power of Rome, but will confront the internal human characteristics, the result in the oppression of others, our need for power, wealth, and control over others. And so Jesus, this new divine authority, therefore confronts evil and empire both externally, but just as important, internally. And I think for me, what's powerful about this is it's not just simply one power replacing another, as we so often see in our world, but it's a far deeper rejection of power over others, of domination, by confronting them not just outside of ourselves, but just as importantly within ourselves. And so right at the very beginning of Mark, it's not just showing the breaking in of a new reign of power, but showing us that this reign will not be about domination and conquest, but rather about humble service and suffering led by the actual Spirit of God. And so Mark's gospel is really redefining power and kingship in a radical way. This isn't the opulence of Roman power with the best food and clothes, architecture and fabric, but it's a leadership rooted in the wilderness and the margins, with fasting, being stripped of most clothing, inhabiting not a palace, but wild barren hills, surrounded by wild beasts, and yet also at the same time surrounded by angelic powers. And so this contrast in just few lines of Mark's gospel is really quite breathtaking. And then Mark ends his origin story with the kingdom of God has come near. John is arrested because the political threat he has become is too much for Herod. Jesus takes up John's proclamation that the new kingdom is near and about to become a reality. And again, this is not a new kingdom with a military overthrowing of Rome, as many had hoped and longed for, but it will be a new kingdom rooted in letting go of all that binds us, externally and internally, and a radical obedience to the Spirit of God in proclaiming justice and liberation or salvation for all. And then really for the rest of Mark's gospel, we are presenting in some ways the collision between these two kingdoms.
Right on. Okay, so my turn. I'm not going to lie, when Deborah said she was going to follow up on our first three episodes with some commentary on the nativity in Mark and John, I was like, how? Why? There is no nativity in Mark and John. Mark and John completely skip over Christ's birth. Mark jumps right to the baptism and John is just high or something and telling you about his trip. Or maybe it's cosmology, something along those lines. But Deborah has switched the focus from the actual nativity to beginnings, and that is something I completely get. Mark is kind of interesting to me as a communication scholar, actually. I'm going to move away from theology for a minute and treat you like some of my students. There will not be a quiz. Mark doesn't start with Jesus so much as he starts with John the Baptist. Yes, as Deborah points out, the first sentence declares this is the gospel of Jesus, but the real heart of the first few verses don't have much to do with Christ himself and have way more to do with his cousin, John. John fulfills the prophecies of Isaiah and preaches repentance and the coming of a great leader out in the wilderness. John's preaching is the focus in the beginning of Mark, and it very quickly transitions into the baptism of Jesus, but the first few verses are all about how John is preparing the way. This appeals to me a great deal as a communication professor, because the focus in the beginning of Mark is not on a miraculous birth or particularly rich or poor visitors, but on a powerful speaker. John is a preacher. In my mind, he's kind of a big tent revival sort of guy. He's the guy who would let the world know that change was coming. And John, bless him, was just kind of a public speaker out there doing his thing. And I know that isn't the important part of the story, but it's important to me.
Mm.
John made his way and his name by being out in the public and out in the wilderness preaching, by saying to a crowd what he thought God wanted them to know. John was a prophet, and like all prophets, his voice was his primary weapon. And as a comm scholar, that means a great deal to me. When we did the episodes on Matthew and Luke, we did a great deal of work to show you who paved the way for Christ's birth and how they did it. They were poor shepherds, rich astronomers, and haggard parents. They brought what they could. But as Deborah has shown you, Christ's ministry was announced not by kings, but by an itinerant preacher. Jesus was brought to you not by visiting wizards or goat herders, but by a man who roamed around speaking to crowds in towns and in the wilderness. He was, quite frankly, a rhetorician. I want to focus on this because speaking actually was a big deal in Rome, and for John to just walk around doing it is profound. I teach a course in rhetorical theory, and in the early weeks, we talk about rhetoric in Rome. For example, we talk about Cicero and his impact on rhetorical theory. Now, I know I say the name Cicero, and a lot of you think, I know that guy was Greek or Roman, and I should probably know something about him, but I don't, and that is fine. You don't have to know a lot about Cicero to appreciate what I'm about to tell you. We don't necessarily make the kinds of connections I'm about to talk about, but the Roman Empire of Cicero is not actually that far removed from the Roman Empire of Jesus. In fact, they're only about 100 years apart. The great philosophers and teachers that we think of as being the forefathers of the West were very much a part of Jesus's environment. Cicero was a Roman citizen who had achieved great renown for his abilities as a speaker and writer. He was what you would have called an activist of his time. He was, in fact, so effective as a speaker and writer that Rome eventually killed him.
Mm.
But that wasn't the end of it. The state cut off his head, and some say even cut out his tongue, and cut off his hands as a signal to future upstarts. They cut off his head and tongue and hands because that's where his power was. He was a speaker and a writer, and as a speaker and a writer, he had a profound impact on the public. So when they executed him, they made a public statement for future writers and speakers to think really hard about. That's something you should keep in mind as you think more about John's future and how they treated him at the end of his life, too. Another thing we talk about in my classes is the importance of something like rhetoric in an empire. That may seem random and dull, but I promise it is actually really relevant. Let's say rhetoric is part of the education system, as it was in Rome. That means we are teaching people to be persuasive, analytical, critical, and to have a voice in public. That also means we are working under the assumption that they will have the opportunity to use their voice in the public sphere. The nature of empire has a direct effect on rhetoric, then. In a democracy, rhetorical education is essential. It is where we learn debate, persuasion, how to analyze problems, how to come to consensus, and how to present our ideas. Rhetoric and democracy thrive together. In an empire, rhetoric has to be phased out of education and left behind. Because in an empire, democracy is weak.
Mm.
People don't have as much free speech. Their voices don't matter. They do not have persuasive power, and they do not have the ability to make changes because the state, not the people, is in charge. When empires are strong and democracy is weak, rhetoric and rhetorical education disappear. Now, I will leave you to wonder whether you ever took a rhetoric class and what that means for us as a people, but that is neither here nor there. In fact, in the years after Jesus, there is a whole movement in Rome to completely defang rhetoric and make it completely about stylistic flourishes and puffery instead of anything persuasive or content-related, specifically because the empire became all-powerful and the voice of the people was so unimportant. This movement is called the Second Sophistic. This should also have you wondering how the macro politics of the day affected your education, for what it's worth. So, what does this mean for the Gospel of Mark? It means John the Baptist is challenging empire. By being a speaker, by bringing his voice into the public, by practicing the art of rhetoric, even if it was communal and culturally traditional and not Greek or Roman, he was announcing to Rome that he challenged their hegemony. Empires love to paint themselves as containing a multiplicity of voices, but colonialism in every era is one power imposing itself on another. It is one power crushing another group under its boot, and here it is, Rome oppressing Israel. But John has the audacity to speak. John has the absolute nerve to go into public and speak out loud and to whoever will listen as a Jewish prophet. John challenges power and hierarchy.
And you know what's interesting, Elizabeth, is I'm just thinking as you're speaking that we forget that John was also challenging Herod and those in his own community that had thrown their lot in with the Empire of Rome. Mm-hmm. And Herod had actually had his father killed, Zechariah, the high priest, when yes. he was a baby. So in some ways, John really has suffered mm-hmm. his own family and family story. So very courageous of him.
Yes. So the reason the opening of Mark is interesting to me is because it's about precisely those things I have chosen to study for my job. It's a guy who wants to make a difference, and he does so by making his voice known, despite the political odds being against him.
Right. And the threat to his own life.
Yeah.
Fascinating connections there. So in John's gospel, John was again writing to Jews and Gentiles who've been kicked out of their societies because of grappling with the religious and philosophical identity of Jesus. And so John begins his origin story with, "In the beginning was the Word." Now, the Greek word here is logos. And so John is saying, "In the beginning was the logos." Logos was a term used in Greco-Roman philosophy for the rational principle that ordered the entire cosmos. And Elizabeth, I'm going to ask you to jump in a bit here about the philosophy of logos, which I'm sure you've studied in greater depth than myself.
Oh my gosh, I am all over this. I'm going to jump in about logos or logos, however you want to say it. Either one is acceptable. Logos is a fun word because on the one hand, it is abundantly clear what it means based on just what it looks like. Logos obviously means logic or logo because it's right there mm-hmm. in the word. Mm-hmm. Surprise, it means both. Logos is reason, word, logic, rationality, symbol. There's a lot that goes into this word. The reason I'm jumping in here is because logos is central and fundamental in rhetoric. Many of you remember from your early days of learning to write or speak the old logos, pathos, ethos stuff. And if you don't, maybe the words sound familiar. But if I'm going to make some rhetorical connections to the Gospels, I can't let this one slide. John's Gospel says, "In the beginning was the Word." So in the beginning was reason, or symbolic logic, or however you want to translate that. But in the very beginning was something that was more than us. Something that was beyond animal, even beyond human. It was reason. It was something intelligent. It was the thought process that ties the universe together. Logos. And I think we need to seriously consider what that tells us. Logos was God, and Logos was with God. God is reason. God is the divine intelligence that organizes the world. God is the system of ideas and words that makes it all make sense. Now, this is a pretty Greco-Roman idea. The Greeks were constantly striving for perfection, and this is coming through loud and clear here. God is rational, God is reasonable, and therefore God will lead us to perfection. But this is important because this is holy, okay? Reason is divine. Reason is holy. Word or logic is something mystical, maybe magical, but something specifically beyond the physical world in which we live. Reason, in short, is godlike. It literally is God. It may seem like this is setting up a paradigm in which God is completely untouchable, but consider our friend Aristotle for a minute. And this is the part you know. Aristotle said that when you are trying to convince someone, you need different kinds of proofs. Specifically, you need artistic and inartistic proofs. The inartistic proofs are just the outside evidence you bring in. You don't have a lot to do with that. It's just information. The artistic proofs are the proofs you create with your own mind. These are the arguments you actually put together. I'm trying not to bore you here, but it actually matters. These inartistic proofs come in three varieties: appeals to logos, appeals to pathos, and appeals to ethos. This just means you create logical appeals, you create emotional appeals, and you create appeals based on your character. Okay, let me put a few pieces together for you. God is logos. We have that. Aristotle makes no claims that people are gods. But Aristotle does present a system by which a person can make an effective argument. But for Aristotle, that requires a balance. You can't have just an emotional argument, for example. An argument has to be a delicate balance of the three appeals that balance out an argument. What is notable is that Aristotle has described this as a way to appeal to people specifically, because this is the measure of a person. People are made of three things: their emotions, their characters, and their reason. So Aristotle says you have to appeal to them in those ways. Logos, pathos, and ethos just aren't how you make an argument. They're how you make a person. We are people of reason, emotion, and personality. So when we think about the concept of logos in John, we need to think about how John is setting up our relationship to God, ourselves, and the divine. God is logos. Logos is reason and symbol. Logos is part of our very being. That holy reason is part of our makeup. I don't know that the writer of John and Aristotle actually sat down and had this conversation, but the ideas are running through all of history.
I love that. I absolutely love that. And you know, so John is saying this reason that orders the whole cosmos is going to be embodied in this one man, Jesus. That Jesus is the full embodiment of all of this that Elizabeth has just been saying, of the fullness of reason, symbol, rationality. So Jesus is the one that the Greco-Roman world have been speaking about. In some ways, John is saying this philosophy that you've studied and known has now become embodied supremely in one person, Jesus. So John doesn't begin with Rome and any empire of the world, but rather begins with the whole cosmos and this rational ordering of the whole cosmos, which is now embodied in Jesus. And this is to remind the readers that no empire can compete with that which orders the whole cosmos, that ultimate power is held by this principle of the logos, the laws which order this whole of the cosmos and are embodied in Jesus, in the very logos before all that was created. So John is saying no imperial power or empire can ever, even in a way, be compared to this man, because he is the one before all powers. And then John says this logos, it took human flesh. And I think the question for readers would be, why would this logos, this divine philosophy, take on a human body? Why? And that is in some ways the question that John wants us to ask. And then this logos chooses, John tells us, to dwell among us. Not among the palaces, not among the temples, which is where power traditionally has been located, but chooses to dwell among us, ordinary human beings. This is in some ways such an anti-imperial concept that it would have shocked readers, because this is a completely new idea. Number one, of the logos taking flesh and living amongst common people. The question that one then has to ask is why again? it's interesting that the Greek word for dwelt here, dwelt amongst us, that word dwelt, eskenosen, is actually the word in Greek for pitched his tent. So if Logos is reminding the Greco-Roman readers of their philosophy, this phrase that's being thrown in, pitched his tent among us, would immediately remind the Jewish readers of the wilderness times when God pitched his tent, called the tabernacle, among them and literally led them through the wilderness. This was the symbolic image of God who chooses to come down in the wilderness and lead them in that tent of the holiest of holies. Now, for Jewish readers, this is saying Yahweh has once again chosen to come down and lead you into freedom. But the tent or the tabernacle will now be the literal body of Jesus that will lead God's people out of oppression. And so John is contrasting here the power of empires and their architecture, palaces, temples, with God's architecture of power in a human being, perhaps the greatest architecture and miracle of all. A human body becomes the dwelling place of God, of the Logos, of Yahweh, and the human body becomes the embodied cosmic power of God. And again, this is such an anti-imperial statement to locate such power, the power of God, in a human being and in a human body. Now, for those who've been kicked out of synagogues in Roman imperial society, this was a reminder that power is not ultimately found in those synagogues, temples, and palaces, but in an ordinary human body, particularly the human body of Jesus. And as we read through future chapters of John, we will see how each time the crowds wish to make him king, Jesus chooses to withdraw. It's almost as though he will not be drawn into military kingdoms of this earth. And when Pilate ultimately asks him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world." For as John reminds us in the very beginning of his gospel, Jesus' kingdom is the one that has no beginning and no end. It is the kingdom before the creation of the cosmos and after the end of the world. Because Jesus is that divine Logos that is over all earthly powers and kingdoms, with no parallel.
Thank you for listening to The Priest and the Prof. Find us at our website, priestandprof.org. If you have any questions or concerns, feel free to contact us at podcast@priestandprof.org. Make sure to subscribe, and if you feel led, please leave a donation at priestandprof.org/donate. That will help cover the costs of this podcast and support the ministries of Trinity Episcopal Church. Thank you, and we hope you have enjoyed our time together today.
Music by AudioNautics.com.